In the winter, they supply heat. In the summer, they supply cooling. And all year round, the engineering services supply enough power to keep the entire Cal Poly campus functioning. The engineering services building is inconspicuously located next to the Graffitz Arc building, but without its presence, this campus would be functioning with candles. I talked with Mr. Arthur Young, the chief engineer for the engineering services, and he told me what some of those ominous contraptions in that building are used for.
Central boiler plant for Cal Poly, its main function is to supply heat to all the major buildings on the campus by an underground steam distribution system. This steam is also used in our major large buildings for cooling through the use of absorption type chilling units.
With over 15,000 people on campus, this unit has to put out an awful lot of power, and it has to put it out all of the time.
The main plant consists of four boilers, each of a 20,000 pound per hour capacity. This plant operates 365 days a year.
Besides all of its practical functions, the plant is used as an instructional tool for many students here on campus.
It's used as a training aid by different engineering areas. Most of the hours now, in fact over half of the operating time for personnel is done with students.
Mr. Young makes it one of his main goals to have a very efficient system here at Cal Poly. And the heating system in the campus dormitories exemplifies both simplicity and efficiency.
The heating and cooling of the dorms at this campus is done from the central plant. Instead of an individual gas or boiler in each dorm, it's done right from the central plant. One man can take care of our entire dorm system for heating, instead of having a man in each building or a person to take care of that. Also, the efficiency is much higher.
The power system on the Cal Poly campus hasn't always been this big and complex. When Mr. Young arrived on the scene some 20 years ago, the system was only about half as big as it is now.
When I first arrived here, which was 20 years ago, we had two boilers and only about four or five major buildings on this system. And in the last 20 years, we've enlarged the campus, and there's roughly over 32 major buildings now on the steam system. And we've added two additional boilers to the central steam plant.
And of course, the present system is constantly being modified. Beginning in June, the engineering services plans to make modifications totaling some $50,000.
Presently, we plan to modify this whole system this summer, and I hope to have it going by September. We replace the entire control system.
It's with this kind of assurance and this kind of continuous effort by Mr. Young and the entire engineering services department that Cal Poly can be assured of constant power, heat, and comfort. For 91 News Watch, this is Tim Tomastic reporting.
There's a lot of theories going around these days as to what has caused this year to be such a rainy one. 91 News Watch talked with Dr. James Calafill, a professor of atmospheric physics here at Cal Poly, and asked him just what has caused all the rain.
Some people feel that it has something to do with the sunspot cycle. So when the sunspots are maximum, or when you have active sun, you essentially get a dry spell. Okay, and then following a dry spell, then you end up with another rain, a wet period, and then it continues on. But that is a conjecture.
We also asked him if the heavy rains are merely one indication of an overall trend in environmental danger caused by, say, increases in atmospheric pollutants.
I think any time you mess with your surrounding, especially the way the fossil fuels are being depleted and burned out, and also the pollution which is created man-made. These are irreversible processes, and we're going to suffer sooner or later. So I do believe that the warming trend could continue and play disaster havoc with our existence. So I would subscribe to the warming, the so-called greenhouse effect.
The professor also told us why San Luis Obispo receives more rain than many other cities along the central coast.
One reason we get more rain is because we have these nice mountains, and these cold, moist air mass come out from the ocean. It gets lifted and get cold, and we get a lot more rain than if the air mass had come straight without any, you know, obstruction. Whenever you have a mountain, air lifts and cools, and we get tons of more precipitation. So I really don't think this is a direct consequence of the messing up we have done to the surroundings. I think this is more of a statistical aberration.
For 91 News Watch, this is Joe Norris.
Renovation plans for Cal Poly's Mustang Stadium are on the move again. Cal Poly officials have approved a revised plan after discarding the original plan because of spiraling costs. The stadium renovation project was first started in 1976 when a committee chaired by then Dean of Students Edward Chandler drafted the plan. The original project would have called for complete removal and replacement of the wooden stands on the west side of the stadium. I asked Executive Dean of Facilities Planning E. Douglas Girard why costs soared on the original project.
What happened was that as we got into the project and various segments of the campus community got involved in expressing their needs, these needs were transmitted to the architect, and at that point the costs started to spiral to satisfy the needs as he interpreted them.
The new proposal calls for repainting and repairing of the old stands. Also in the plan is the installation of new steel bleachers near the upper corners of the east side stands to provide some 900 additional seats. I also asked Girard which repairs will be paid for by donations from original project supporters.
Only those items that are associated with improving the seating capacity will be charged against the pledges that have been made by the people that have donated. Many of the other improvements, the repainting, the structural renovation, for example, will be from non-donated sources. We're not sure yet exactly where that'll be, but it certainly will not come from that source.
Other improvements that will be made to the stadium will be to improve and expand existing restroom facilities and modify the present press box structure. Girard went on to say that the County of San Luis Obispo will donate a $6,000 grant, which will go to providing seating for handicapped persons. For 91 News Watch, this is Romero Perez reporting.
Cal Poly juniors and seniors, graduation is not that far away. If you're one of those students who doesn't know exactly how to go about looking for a job, relax. The Cal Poly Placement Center is there to help. 91 News Watch talked to Director of Placement Richard Equinoa about the services offered at the Placement Center.
The services can range anywhere from getting the name of an employer, name of a person to contact, all the way through the whole job seeking process, helping them define what it is they want to do, making contact with the employers, drafting up their resume, going through interview training workshops, going through the actual on-campus interview here, evaluation studies, deciding on which company to go with and which factors to consider, things like that. So it runs the whole gamut.
Equinoa talked about the job prospects for seniors.
A lot of students, college graduates, are of the opinion, because they read a lot of newspaper articles, that, you know, if you're a college graduate, forget it. There's no chance of you getting a job. I'm here to tell you point blank, you know, that there are jobs for college graduates. It just depends on the flexibility of the student in terms of where they want to go, the type of work that they want to do, the salary considerations. a number of factors.
91 News Watch asked Equinoa when a student should start thinking about obtaining a job.
My recommendation is that they're here, that they come into our placement center. If they know what they want to do, they come into our placement center in the last quarter of their junior year.
Juniors and seniors, the placement center is available. There's nothing to lose and a job to gain. For 91 News Watch, this is Lori Hickey.
One. There's good news for women graduating from college this year. Job offers are up for women nearly 40% from last year. But the really good jobs, the ones in the hot fields like engineering and computer sciences, mostly will go to men. According to Gloria Liebrenz, head of the Career Planning and Placement Center at the University of California, San Diego, the jobs are there only for women who are qualified.
They're not enough. There are more than we have ever had before. At least in recent years. And so that is the good news. That is that women who have good mathematics background and are capable of doing this kind of work, and I think we've had women like that all along, are now going into using those skills in academic programs which more directly lead to good job offers in the labor market.
The UC job placement expert says most women college students are still confining themselves to the traditional women's areas of liberal arts, taking courses like sociology, art history, and English. But if a woman college student wants to have a surefire career, she needs to have a good idea of what she wants and go after it in college.
It is not, quote, easy for perhaps the history major or someone like myself, a political science major, to come right out of school, have any kind of career direction without a lot of previous planned thought and work, and have a job waiting. That was true in the 1960s, but it is not true now.
In other words, know the job market before you graduate. From the University of California, this is Bruce Tokars reporting.
One. If you're heading for the out-of-doors, look out for one of the most common causes of skin allergies, the shrub called poison oak.
In the resin canals of the plant, there are chemicals, and if you break or crush the leaf or the stem or any part of it, this oil runs out, and that's the material that contains these allergens that produce the rash.
Dr. William Epstein is on California Medical Association's advisory panel on dermatology. He says be careful to keep the poison oak from spreading.
And it sticks to things. So it'll stick to the fur, it'll stick to clothing, golf balls. You hit your golf ball into the poison oak and it'll be on the golf ball. And then it gets on your hand, goes from your hand, wherever you put your hand, you can spread the poison oak.
The best thing to do for poison oak is to stay away from it. But if you believe you've come in contact with the plant, Dr. Epstein says one of the first things to do is thoroughly wash your skin and clothing. This is Linda Conti reporting from San Francisco. Two, one. Unfortunately, it's poison oak time in California again. Reaction to this plant occurs when a thick oil in the leaves comes in contact with the skin or is inhaled when being burned. California Medical Association's Dr. William Epstein says it's hard to keep poison oak from spreading, especially if you've walked in it.
It gets on your hand, goes from your hand, wherever you put your hand. It's on your shoes, your boots, and you take your boot off and you got it on your hand, you put your hand down on the chair, and now you have it on the chair. And that's how it spreads.
It's a good idea to avoid exposure if you can, since there isn't much that can be done once the rash develops.
The treatments are not very good. If you know you've gotten into poison oak, the very best thing to do is to wash off immediately. Because you can, if you wash off quickly and you're not too sensitive to it, get the material off.
Dr. Epstein says that advances are being made in developing a vaccine that may someday provide total protection from poison oak. This is Linda Conti reporting from San Francisco.
In 1897, when an attempt to drill for oil turned up only mineral water, Sycamore Mineral Springs began as a health spa in Avila Beach. It flourished as an attraction for relaxation as people came to bathe in the mineral water. In September of 1976, Sycamore Springs bought their first Redwood hot tub. I talked with Harvey Rhodes, the manager of Sycamore Springs, and asked him what attracts people to the springs.
The main thing about the hot tubs is that they make you feel good, to help relieve the pain of arthritis, rheumatism, pruritus, backache, to relax you, the mineral water that makes you just feel real good. People are really responding to them lately because you have to do something to relax, and this is one of the easiest ways to do it.
The hot tubs range in size from 5 to 8 feet and hold anywhere from 1 to 14 people. I asked Rhodes what you could expect if you rented a tub.
We have the hot tubs scattered throughout the hills, underneath the oak trees, sycamore trees, and the pine trees. And every one of the hot tubs is located in a different location. The most popular time is at night, and that's what seems to be when everybody enjoys it the most, because they can look at the stars. And it's really more or less romantic, which is one of our main ideas here, because this is probably one of the prettiest settings in the whole area.
Who frequents the hot tubs most? Rhodes told me his clientele ranged from 2 months to 96 years old, 25% of those being college age. Future plans for Sycamore Mineral Springs include an addition of a 12-foot tub called El Grande, which Rhodes said will probably be their party tub. For 91 Newswatch, this is Nancy Bauer.
The Jarvis Gann Initiative is not a popular subject with the League of Women Voters. The League's local government coordinator, Kathy Hutchinson, says Proposition 13 is in conflict with three of the organization's basic goals: an equitable tax base, adequate revenue for state and local government services, and a well-maintained educational system. Ms. Hutchinson, who spoke to a Cal Poly journalism class last week, says a major question to ask of the measure is how the local government will be funded if property taxes are reduced to 1%.
There is absolutely no description in the Jarvis Initiative as to how this 1% is to be distributed. And I feel that this is another problem, because if you are taking 1% of, after you have removed $7 billion from what was a $9.5 billion source last year, and if Jarvis does not go through and there are no changes, it would be a little over $10 billion from the property tax source. You can see where local governments would really have a problem.
She claims the initiative says nothing about the measure, how the measure will affect the homeowner if his home is devalued, and warns that it will remove government financing from local control.
There are several areas where this could happen under the Jarvis Initiative. And that is, first, you have to consider the 1% limit. That cannot be changed. Even if a local district wants to raise that limit, they cannot. There's also the fact that there is a two-thirds limit of the qualified electors to raise special taxes.
Finally, Ms. Hutchinson claims business and not the private individual will get most of the relief from Jarvis Gann.
65% of the relief would go to business, 35% would go to private individuals. And this would escalate again as the years progressed. People talk about Jarvis again, as I said before, and as a one-year, one-shot deal. They don't consider the fact that as these homes are sold more and more frequently than businesses are, homes are sold seven times more frequently than businesses. So you know that they are going to be paying a higher and higher percentage of the total property tax load than they have been. And as the years progress, this would become more and more of a problem.
For 91 Newswatch, this is Joe Norris reporting.
One, two, three. It's been around for millions of years, but suddenly the sun is becoming the focus of world attention because many people believe it's the energy of the future. It isn't really as easy as it seems. Adopting solar energy to replace oil, gas, coal, and uranium will be, at best, a long, costly, and uncertain process. But solar energy has so much going for it, supporters want an all-out drive to base the nation's economy on energy drawn directly or indirectly from the light and heat of the sun. One solar activist is Dennis Hayes, who originated the idea for the recent Sunday demonstrations. Hayes says the leadership in the solar energy drive is not in Washington, but all over the U.S. Companies, local governments, and private citizens are building, encouraging, and inventing new solar projects. Hayes says supporters hope to see the federal solar energy budget doubled in fiscal year 1979. Instead, he says, it was cut. Vivi St. Amand for 91 Newswatch. Three, two, one. House Speaker Tip O'Neill says he's not sure when the House of Representatives will begin televising its sessions. And he says Congress and not outsiders should retain control over that process. The House Rules Committee issued a report on broadcast system options in February. A House-passed resolution required the Speaker to devise and implement a broadcast system promptly after that report was completed. O'Neill has told reporters that technical problems still must be worked out. He says the congressman should decide if a broadcast system should be installed or not. The speaker says the American public is entitled to, in his words, gavel-to-gavel coverage under the control of professionals. But, he says, the operation will be a disaster if the professionals are responsible to anyone other than to the House. Vivi St. Amand, 91 Newswatch. Three, two, one. News in the entertainment world for this Tuesday, May 16th. Elizabeth Taylor and Joseph Bottoms will star in Return Engagement, a 90-minute Hallmark Hall of Fame drama to be seen on NBC next season. Miss Taylor plays a former musical stage star who retired from public life when she was deserted by her husband and partner. She becomes a professor of ancient history in a small college where her identity is discovered by Joseph Bottoms. Joseph Hardy directs that drama. William Holden, Gene Kelly, Marcia Mason, and John Wayne will star in Oscar's Best Actors, an ABC special airing May 23rd. Charles Haidt and Swoozie Kurtz have been signed for Oliver's Story. Ashanti, a story of modern-day slave trading in Africa and the Mideast, has begun filming in Kenya and Israel. It stars Michael Caine, Omar Sharif, Peter Ustinov, Rex Harrison, Telly Savalas, and Beverly Todd. Sharif plays a nomad who teams up with Caine to track down a ruthless slave trader, played by Ustinov, who has kidnapped his wife, played by Miss Todd. Savalas is a mercenary helicopter pilot, and Harrison is a representative of an underground anti-slavery organization. An NBC executive who, like all of us, spends a lot of time on the freeways got to thinking about what would happen if the person in the next car had a gun. Deanne Barkley, vice president for motion pictures and miniseries, puts it this way. There's so much senseless violence in Los Angeles. I remember looking out of my car one day and wondering if one of those people could be mad as hell and take a shot at me. Ms. Barkley has made her idea into a best-selling book and soon-to-be movie called Freeway. And CBS has unveiled its fall TV schedule. The network will replace Bob Newhart and Kojak, but bring back Mary Tyler Moore in an hour-long variety show on Sundays. 6.5 hours of programs are being replaced. Others are being shuffled around. Only the Thursday primetime schedule will remain unchanged. Vivi St. Amand in the entertainment world for 91 Newswatch. Three, two, one. A study suggests that smokers may be deceiving themselves if they think they're less likely to get smoking-related diseases by switching to low-tar and nicotine cigarettes. The two-year study, which involved about 30 smokers, was conducted by Harvard University's Tobacco and Health Research Program. It was funded by the National Institutes of Health and by seven tobacco companies. The studies say most smokers who hold the smoke from low-tar cigarettes in their lungs longer in an apparent effort to extract more satisfaction. Vivi St. Amand for 91 Newswatch. Three, two, one. Ken Carey and his wife Sherry left California and went to the Ozarks of Missouri to find a more healthy environment for their five children. But they soon became disappointed with the education the children were receiving in public schools. Then they met up with Charlie Sisson, a young teacher who had come to the Ozarks to avoid the violence of the Detroit schools. The result is a 16 by 32 foot concrete block, one-room schoolhouse built on the Carey's 80-acre farm. Ken Carey explained that it wasn't the idea of the public school that motivated him to start that school, but as he says, we felt helpless in the face of attitudes and ideas that children were being exposed to, ideas about how people relate to each other and to institutions, ideas we feel handicap an individual in life. The Careys pay Sisson a small salary to teach and pay for operating costs from the tuition the parents of the other seven children at the school pay. But the going wasn't easy. The Careys ran into a little trouble. They said public school officials threatened to contact the Shannon County prosecutor. But the prosecutor says he looked into the matter and couldn't bring any truancy charges because the children were at least going to some kind of school. The Carey family says they reviewed school law before going into the project. Their school receives no tax money, is located about 75 yards from the Carey home in a thick grove of trees. What a way to go. Vivi St. Amand for 91 Newswatch. 3, 2, 1. Researchers report that the sauce on McDonald's Big Macs contains a food additive to which some people are allergic. They say a 35-year-old woman was stricken with life-threatening symptoms while eating one of those hamburgers. Symptoms of allergic reaction to the additive include swelling, itching, and shortness of breath. These are the symptoms cited by four physicians at McGill University Teaching Hospital in Montreal. They issued the warning in a letter in the latest issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. The four said they wanted to alert physicians to the hidden allergen in view of the widespread consumption of Big Macs. A spokesman at McDonald's headquarters in Oak Brook, Illinois, Douglas Timberlake, says the additive, derived from Middle Eastern mountain shrubs, is used in many foods and is considered safe by the Food and Drug Administration. He says the matter will be investigated by McDonald's Quality Assurance Department. Vivi St. Amand, Between the Golden Arches, for 91 Newswatch.
The police department here at Cal Poly is mostly known for their never-ending efforts in giving out parking citations, but what they would like to be known as is a public service organization. 91 Newswatch talked with acting campus police chief Leroy Whitmer, and he told us that they are not a security force, but rather a bona fide police force.
It's a police department, and it's not a security department. And the word security comes from, you know, many, many, many years ago when we rattled doors and were really night watchmen. And the department has actually progressed considerably. All of our officers are recognized as peace officers as defined in the penal code. We are a member of POST, which is Peace Officer Standards and Trainings. We have to adhere to the same minimum standards that the Sheriff's Department or City Police do.
But they won't be known as the Campus Police for long. The Campus Police Department and the Campus Fire Department will be merging to form a new department that will be known as the Office of Public Safety.
In a few months, we'll be called the Office of Public Safety. Our new chief will have a dual title. He'll be the Director of Public Safety / Chief of Police. and this will be a Department of Public Safety.
During the course of the year, almost everyone on campus will have some confusion as to how the parking system on campus works. During the summer break last year, there were some modifications made that not everyone was aware of when they came back in the fall. Chief Whitmer explains that the parking lot on campus is divided up into three sections.
C area, or the park, is composed of the parking lot areas closest to California Boulevard in the southwest section of campus. G areas feed off Grand Avenue on the southeast corner of the campus. H areas are off the northwest side, feeding in off Highland Drive.
Many of the students wonder why the campus police carry guns, 357 Magnums no less, when there has rarely been an instance when a campus policeman has had a reason to draw his weapon.
It's a tool of the trade. It's recognized by the courts as such. And by reason of his position, a peace officer is placed in a position where he might have to respond to a situation where he would need the weapon. I have personally only drawn my weapon three times out here.
Chief Whitmer told us that Cal Poly rarely has any trouble when there are special events on campus, like Poly Royal or a music concert.
Things normally run very smooth. For Poly Royal, we have everybody we have on duty, but our problems are really very minor. You'll get a few cases of malicious mischief or petty theft during Poly Royal. But most of our problems are medical emergency type. Somebody will cut a hand, or we've had people with broken arms and legs or heart attacks, things like that, where officers respond and give first aid.
When asked if there was one thing that the police department would like to emphasize to the students, Chief Whitmer said, yes, there is.
We are a service organization, and we're here to serve the community, and that's the image we want for the department, one of people who are here to help.
For 91 News Watch, this is Tim Tomastic reporting.
In 1897, an attempt to drill for oil in Avila Beach turned up only mineral water. Rather than abandon the well, Sycamore Mineral Springs turned it into a health spa. It flourished as an attraction for relaxation as people came to bathe in the mineral water. 2 years ago, Sycamore Springs bought their first Redwood hot tub. 91 News Watch talked with Harvey Rhodes, manager of Sycamore Springs, and asked him what attracts people to the springs.
The main thing about the hot tubs is that they make you feel good, to help relieve the pain of arthritis, rheumatism, pruritus, backache, to relax you. The mineral water makes you just feel real good. People are really responding to them lately because you have to do something to relax, and this is one of the easiest ways to do it.
The hot tubs range in size from 5 to 8 feet and hold anywhere from 1 to 14 people. We asked Rhodes what you could expect if you rented a tub.
We have the hot tubs scattered throughout the hills, underneath the oak trees, the sycamore trees, and the pine trees. And every one of the hot tubs is located in a different location. The most popular time is at night, and that seems to be everybody enjoys it the most because they can look at the stars, and it's really more or less romantic, which is one of our main ideas here, because this is probably one of the prettiest settings in the whole area.
Who frequents the hot tubs most? Rhodes said his clientele ranged from 2 months to 96 years old, 25% of those being college age. Future plans for Sycamore Mineral Springs include an addition of a 12-foot tub called El Grande, which Rhodes said will probably be their party tub. For 91 News Watch, this is Nancy Bauer. San Luis Obispo County has many social service agencies available to citizens who need specialized help. One of these, the Victims Assistance Center, after just 1 year and 2 months of operation, has aided over 1,100 victims of crimes, especially violent crimes. 91 News Watch spoke with the Victims Assistance Center coordinator, Alan Bond, and asked him what the main objective of the center was.
Basically, we're just trying to give the victims the equal amount of rights as the criminals. And that's just the main thing. We just talk with them and explain or try to find out what their needs are. They've varied on everything from needing psychological help to moving from the county to not really needing anything at all. It's each person's different. It depends on their own makeup.
If you feel you are a victim of crime, Bond told us how you get in touch with the center or how they find you.
You get in contact with victims is, first of all, when the police departments in the county take a report, they're supposed to give the victim a pamphlet explaining our program. Otherwise, we get a copy of the face sheet of the police report within 2 to 3 days later, and then we contact the victim either by telephone or in person or by letter, depending on the severity of the crime. We're also on 24-hour call through Rape Crisis Hotline and through all the police agencies. If a major crime takes place in the county, we're called out immediately to start working with the victims.
The Victims Assistance Center is successful and growing. We asked Bond why.
Well, the main reason being is our county, all the social service agencies and all the police agencies work well together. And like in our county, we have a Victim Assistance Advisory Committee made up of members of all police departments and all social service agencies that meet once a month and discuss what they can do to help the victims and any problems we're having we can work out at that time. So it's basically because of our county and the way everybody cooperates why it's working so well.
Approximately 26 other states are establishing some sort of victims assistance centers. Bond says San Luis Obispo County's is considered one of the best in the nation. For 91 Newswatch, this is Nancy Bauer. Last year, San Luis Obispo Police Department qualified to receive a grant to combat traffic problems. Accidents had reached a high proportion for the population and miles traveled in San Luis Obispo. The federal grant enabled the department to hire 3 traffic officers for the traffic enforcement and education. 91 Newswatch talked with Traffic Safety Officer Harold White and asked him how they are making use of the money from the grant.
We're out there trying to find the violators, which are numerous, and enforcing the traffic laws and having to keep a strict traffic enforcement to try to reduce our traffic accidents, which we have done. So we feel that by working a strict traffic enforcement, we are reducing accidents, or at least we've stopped the steady 11% to 13% increase per year. And right now, we've been matter of fact, reducing it just of a very minor percent, but it's at least a sign of something good.
We asked Officer White what he thought was the main reason for traffic accidents in San Luis Obispo.
Inattention. That is the main cause of any accident. Inattention. Inattention caused a person to travel too fast. Inattention caused a person to try to turn quicker and fail to yield the right of way. Inattention is looking off and running into the rear of someone.
So the accident rate in San Luis Obispo is going down, but the injury rate is going up. Officer White told us why.
We feel that if everyone tries to cooperate, it will help. It will greatly help this department and the city to reduce on the property damage which is involved in any type of accident and injury. Our injury rate is going up, although our accident rate is going down. Therefore, we feel that the accidents now that are causing injury are from the excessive speed. Speed plays to some degree in every accident. It might be 1%, it may be 99%, but excessive speed to one degree plays in a part of an accident.
An ounce of prevention, they say, is worth a pound of cure. This is Nancy Bauer for 91 Newswatch.
The Environmental Center of San Luis Obispo County is full of information about alternate energy sources and all types of environmental concerns. We spoke with Alan Matthews at the center about just exactly what it is they do.
Well, one of the main things we're doing at the Environmental Center in San Luis is a recycling project. We do the recycling for San Luis County now that SORT is doing the local recycling, and we have drop-off points in various cities in the county where people can leave their glass, newspapers, and aluminum cans, and even oil from the car. So recycling is one of the main things that the Environmental Center does. We also have a huge amount of information here on alternate energy projects, on just about anything to do with the environment.
The Environmental Center is located at 985 Palm Street. It's open 10 to 4, Monday through Friday, and everyone is welcome to go by and visit. This is Bev Langlois for 91 Newswatch.
Three, two, one. A saxophonist may have taught a wolf to sing. When Paul Winter took his saxophone into Wolf Park, Indiana one night and serenaded the wolves, one female wolf joined Winter in a duet long into the night. It was recorded and it'll be on Winter's next album. The director of Wolf Park is a professor at Purdue University who says the concert may have wide scientific ramifications. Dr. Eric Klinghammer says that for the next four nights, that wolf howled in a manner distinctly influenced by the tune Winter had been playing. Well, do you think a recording of wolf cries could ever make the top 40? For 91 Newswatch, I'm Donna Pangburn. Three, two, one. Can you imagine returning home one day only to discover that while you were gone, your home had been converted into a parking lot? Well, that's what's in store for one of California's rarest birds. Any day now, the California lease terns will return to their nesting spot on Terminal Island in Los Angeles Harbor and find they've become victims of the automobile age. That's a warning to car owners. Officials say the terns might have to do their breeding in the back seat of an automobile. For four of the last 5 years, their nesting site has been an abandoned airstrip known as Reeves Field, regarded as the second most productive breeding area in the state. However, the Harbor Department has converted Reeves Field into a parking lot for cars being imported from overseas. One Fish and Game official calls it a no-good situation. The lease tern is the smallest of the tern family. It's about 9 inches long and ranges from Baja, California to San Francisco. So don't be surprised if you happen to park your car on Terminal Island in Los Angeles Harbor and return to find it the nesting place for an endangered species of bird, the lease tern. For 91 Newswatch, I'm Donna Pangburn. Three, two, one. Is there intelligent life in outer space? How many times have scientists attempted to answer that question? Well, two astronomers in Washington say that the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which could have habitable planets circling them, is much greater than previously believed. Scientists at Kitt Peak Observatory in Arizona now estimate that about 10% of the galaxy's 100 billion stars could have planets orbiting them. And the more planets there are to choose from, the greater the possibility that some may support Earth-like life. That's a warning to all you who scoff at sci-fi fantasies. Star Wars may not be that far away. For 91 Newswatch, I'm Donna Pangburn. Three, two, quit it, microphone. Three, two, one. Childrensville, USA. A dreamland amusement park? Far from it. Newly opened in California just last month, Childrensville, USA is a rural home for battered youngsters. The 120-acre facility is near Beaumont, about 80 miles from Los Angeles. It aims to help both children and parents in separate clinics. The children are given surrogate parents, whom they call aunt and uncle, and the real parents and their youngsters are brought together for gradually increasing amounts of time until they can once again get along with each other. Help for abused children and guidance for their parents. These are just two projects undertaken by women of the U.S. today. For 91 Newswatch, I'm Donna Pangburn. Three, two, one. Ever chomp some lightly breaded shrimp, only to wonder where the shrimp was? Or perhaps you selected fresh asparagus, and you got a vegetable that tasted canned or frozen instead. Eating out is a prime recreation for millions of Americans, but investigations indicate that it's also become a source of potential fraud. While most restaurants usually describe their products accurately, menu writers can sometimes indulge in flights of fancy to make things sound more attractive to the customer. For example, many frogs' legs are listed as domestic when they're really imported. Less expensive blue cheese may be substituted for Roquefort. Half and half may replace cream, and the quality of meat may not reach the level listed on the menu. Robert Hills of Washington has studied menu fraud investigations in the nation's capital and in Los Angeles, and he's written a booklet describing the problem. It tells you what you can do and what to look for to determine if you are being taken. Copies of Truth in Menu can be obtained by mail for 50 cents from Emerson's Limited. The address is 11790 Park Lawn Drive, Rockville, Maryland, 20852. This is Donna Pangburn reporting for 91 Newswatch. 3, 2, 1. A top travel agency in London is launching a new winter vacation spot for sun-starved Britons, Timbuktu. The little town of 7,000 people is famous as a cliche for a far-off place with a funny name, but it really exists in Mali, a former French colony in West Africa. The London Timbuktu package will cost the equivalent of $638 for a 7-day safari. The tourist agent who's arranging the tour says the hotel in Timbuktu is fairly basic. He says the town has no bank, only one shop, and so far at least, no postcards of Timbuktu. For 91 Newswatch, I'm Donna Pangburn.
A friend in need always has a friend at the San Luis Obispo County Hotline. The toll-free number has been in existence here on the Central Coast for about 8 years now, operating for the sole purpose of helping people. 91 Newswatch called the hotline number and talked to Liz, who told us exactly what the hotline program offers the community.
It's a place for somebody to call at any time. It's supposed to be a crisis phone, also anybody that wants any kind of information or a temporary shelter, people call and we do what we can for them.
Liz went by her first name only, as one of the basic advantages of the hotline service is that all calls are anonymous. Liz explained that it is very important for the people who call to know this.
That's the basis of our work, because if somebody, you know, if we didn't do that, why, you know, nobody would feel comfortable to calling hotline.
Since Hotline began some 8 years ago, they have tallied up endless calls from people with all kinds of problems, some of them as serious as an attempted suicide and others as incidental as a pet cat stuck up in a tree. But for the people at Hotline, they are all just as important.
Calls from people who are, say, having problems with alcoholism, or they're not feeling well, or they have a friend who seems to be having mental problems or something, and they don't know where to call, they'll call us and we'll give them some suggestions. Or if somebody wants to know where a referral, we've got quite a big list of referrals for almost anything you can think of, you know, within the city or even around the county. There's, you know, people call sometimes from Tascadero. Or some people just call just because they need somebody to talk to, and we're here, and we're happy to talk with them.
When and if you ever need a friend or someone to talk to, any time of the day or any day of the year, the number is 544-6162 for the San Luis Obispo County Hotline. For 91 Newswatch, this is Tim Tomastic reporting.
Count 3, 2, 1. It looks as though an LNG terminal will be built somewhere on the California coastline. The terminal will not only serve California, but it will also serve the western half of the United States. With the movement of large quantities of natural gas, there is a possibility of catastrophe. And during a visit to Washington, 91 Newswatch asked Public Information Officer for the U.S. Department of Energy, James Bishop, who would be responsible in the event of an LNG terminal accident.
Not really. The Carter administration is putting together a task force right now to determine a lot of questions about safety. But the question of where the responsibility lies between the federals and the state and the counties has to be worked out. It's a new problem. But the expectation is that there's not going to be that much liquid natural gas imported into this country over the next 20 years. So that there'll only be a few states where this is going to be a problem.
We then asked Bishop who would be regulating and in charge of the terminal.
But that's Governor Brown and the state PUC. And I'm not even sure there's going to be federal permits involved. But there'll probably have to be an environmental impact statement, which is an EPA problem, not a DOE problem. DOE's responsibility is a regulatory one, which is to regulate the importation of that gas. But the Environmental Protection Agency has the responsibility of working with the National Environmental Policy Act to determine the impacts of it. But Carter is concerned, the president is concerned about it, so we will have to try to come up with a broader policy in terms of the safety question.
That was Public Information Officer for the U.S. Department of Energy, James Bishop. For 91 News Watch, this is Dave Curley. 3, 2, 1. President Carter's energy plan is still in Congress and facing many problems. 91 News Watch talked to the Public Information Officer of the U.S. Department of Energy, James Bishop, and asked what impact, if passed, the plan would have on California residents.
One of the most important impacts, in my judgment, is the conservation package, which offers tax credits for solar and conservation to schools, to hospitals, to homeowners, and to factories. Tax credits of significant amounts will be available to people who want to move to solar energy. In the area of utility rate reform, the state, you know, will be under some direction now, although not in a mandatory way, to study rate structures in the state. Now, California happens to be quite ahead of everybody else, so that California, in the area of peak load pricing and time of day pricing and lifeline, things like that, stands in a very good position to point the way for the rest of the country, because it's quite possible that by making utilities more efficient than they are, and working these rate reforms, that on the order of $50 to $100 billion in money that might otherwise be spent for new utility plants can be avoided. Because on the average, only about 55% of the average utility uses the capacity that it has. And a lot of the new capacity is being built for peak load. Now the whole point is if you can flatten that peak load out, which is what different rates would do, what you've done is take a tremendous amount of pressure off the environment and also off the capital market.
And in what other ways will California be affected?
On coal conversion, which is another one of these proposals, it's quite obvious that coal, you know, cannot be burned in the Los Angeles basin. But there are hopes in the future that coal, by using technology such as fluidized bed and solvent refined coal can be converted into a clean substance, so that coal in an indirect way can be burned in California.
That's Public Information Officer for the U.S. Department of Energy, James Bishop. For 91 News Watch, this is Dave Curley. Take two, three. 3, 2, 1. A new department was formed in the U.S. government this year. It's the Department of Energy. 91 News Watch talked to the Public Information Officer of that department, James Bishop, and asked what the role of the Energy Department is.
Congress this year, and it's an amalgamation of all existing agencies, so that in the first year we are exactly that. We are kind of the sum of all the parts of all the bureaucracy that was once there. But as time goes by, this department is going to be much smaller, and its budget's going to be smaller. One reason why there's an energy department is that senators demand service from the federal government, as do governors. So we're here to serve the states and the consumers. We don't produce a lot of energy, but we make it possible for energy to be produced. So Senator Hayakawa's comments are appreciated, we think that the DOE is going to be worth its salt.
That's the Public Information Officer for the U.S. Department of Energy, James Bishop. For 91 News Watch, this is Dave Curley.
Just 1 week ago today, the body of former Italian Premier Aldo Moro was found bullet-riddled and dumped in the back seat of a red Renault on a busy Rome street. an Italian terrorist group called the Red Brigades claimed responsibility for Morrow's 59-day kidnapping and his vicious execution. The Brigades are also accused of murdering 12 others and wounding 23, mostly top Italian executives. 91 News Watch talked with Cal Poly professor of modern European history, Dr. Dan Krieger, and asked him exactly who this feared terrorist group is.
The Red Brigades are comprised essentially of dissatisfied Italian youth between the ages of about 18 and 30 years of age. They generally come from middle class or bourgeois families, especially of the upper middle class bourgeois family, and some of them even are sons and daughters of the leaders of the Italian Communist Party.
Krieger explained that the Red Brigades evolved about the same time as the international youth movement of the 1960s.
For the European youth, and especially for the youth of Italy and France, the year 1968 is critical. If you will remember, in 1968, in the spring of 1968, there was a great student uprising in Paris in which the whole government of France was paralyzed, and eventually it led to the resignation of Charles de Gaulle, the president of France. A similar move took place in Italy, and at this time the youth groups, whether they were the French students or the what is now identified as the Brigata Rossa in Italy, broke both with their families and also with traditional radicalism. They do not identify themselves as communists. They identify themselves as sort of post-communist. Sometimes they call themselves neo-Trotskyites. Another favorite term they use amongst themselves is international idiots.
Krieger claims Italy's hard-hit economy and the rapid changes after World War II created the environment in which the Red Brigade movement grew.
Unemployment in Italian families and industrial towns, and especially in the south, in what they call the land of the midday sun, the Mezzogiorno, is tremendously high. And Italian youth, the members of the Brigata Rossa, have banded together in great numbers, partly in frustration to these economic conditions. I would estimate that the numbers of the Brigata Rossa are perhaps 100 times larger than that of the Weathermen in the 1960s.
Within the next half hour, Dr. Krieger will explain why the Red Brigades executed Aldo Moro, whether or not the Italian government acted wisely in not dealing with the terrorists for Moro's life, and also if terrorism is stoppable. For 91 News Watch, I'm Joe Norris reporting. In the last half hour, 91 News Watch, during an interview with Dr. Dan Krieger, a professor of modern European history here at Cal Poly, explored the characteristics and evolution of the Italian terrorist group, the Red Brigades. We now continue that interview by asking Dr. Krieger what motives the Red Brigades would have in executing Italy's former premier, Aldo Moro.
The philosophy of the Brigata Rossa is essentially to bring on the destruction of the Italian government. And anything that frustrates the Italian government, anything that forces it to take repressive measures, anything which demonstrates its incompetence, and I think for the average Italian, when they couldn't find their former prime minister, there's a measure of incompetence revealed. Anything that demonstrates this incompetence helps to tear down the government. This is exactly what they want.
Krieger explained that the Italian government was wise in not releasing imprisoned terrorists to the Red Brigades, even though the group had threatened to execute Aldo Moro.
I think once you start to make deals with a terrorist, you leave yourself open to no end of trouble. And traditionally, governments have found it simply does not pay to make those kinds of deals. And I don't suppose the Italian government had any alternative other than to keep the terrorist interred and refuse to negotiate despite Aldo Moro's pleading letters.
Krieger explained that even though other nations have had to deal with terrorist activity before, the political climate in Italy makes the Italian brand of terrorism quite unique.
I suppose any nation has to prepare for this type of contingency. The West Germans, of course, have a very effective anti-terrorist program, as demonstrated recently in their rescue of the passengers from the Lufthansa airliner. The British have done this for very, very many years. In fact, most European nations where there is a tradition of civil unrest have trained anti-terrorist groups. I think it is unfortunate if we go overboard, if any country goes overboard in preparing anti-terrorist, counter-terrorist, counter-insurgency activity, unless it's really needed. I just can't foresee the kinds of circumstances developing here in the United States, which exist in Italy today.
We also asked Dr. Krieger if international terrorism is stoppable.
No, you can't stop it altogether. The nation of Israel probably has the most effective anti-terrorist organization, and we can see from time to time they have great tragedies where the terrorists actually succeed in blowing up a bus or machine gunning down passengers coming off airplanes at Lod Airport.
For 91 Newswatch, I'm...
Police decoy officers get mugged for a living. I'm Cheryl Jennings. Police decoy officer Dorothy Jorgensen feels the decoy approach is one of the best ways to stop violent crime against helpless old men and women. She works with three backup officers who monitor her from nearby hiding places, trucks, vans, cars, buildings, or bushes in high-crime areas. She disguises herself as a sick old woman and remains motionless when a possible suspect starts checking her out.
I never look at the persons who are around me. I keep my eyes closed and my head is turned away from my wallet or purse I'm carrying. This is particularly important because I wouldn't be able to continue to do this work if my head was bashed in.
As she's leaning against the wall or post, waiting for her purse to get ripped off, she realizes what many old people feel, total helplessness.
You feel so vulnerable when you're out there. You have someone's strange hands and arms. They're touching your shoulder. They're touching your arm. They're looking in your purse. They're rifling through your belongings.
Then someone, possibly a good Samaritan or a potential mugger, begins looking her over.
He's touching me. He continues to touch me. He may reach up on my shoulder, and then he may even try to feel my pulse. And I don't move, and then all of a sudden a hand goes down, and before I know it, the wallet or the coin purse is taken from my purse.
Jorgensen then gives a signal to the backup unit that someone has taken her property.
He goes past a telephone booth. He goes past some store in the nearby vicinity where he could call for help if he was really concerned about my well-being. He goes on maybe 100 feet, maybe half a block. There's someone else near him. The person steps up to him and identifies himself as a police officer and says he's under arrest for grand theft, taking property from the person of another.
The suspects are booked for grand theft at the county jail, and the legal and judicial process begins. There has been much harsh criticism of the decoy program. Some call it entrapment. What if the person had good motives? What if they just wanted to help the old woman or man? Officer in charge of the street crimes unit, Lieutenant Charles Bean, says the decoy unit uses passive police conduct, which provides an opportunity for the crime to occur, rather than soliciting or encouraging the crime. Arrests from the decoy program's first year in operation have resulted in a 75% to 80% conviction rate, more than double the national average. Over 80% of those arrested had prior convictions. Lieutenant Bean says decoy officers can provide more accurate testimony in court than can a frightened victim because police know what information is needed. And many victims may not testify at all because they fear repercussion. Punishment for those convicted varies greatly. On the average, the district attorney's office asks for 90 days. The suspect, on the average, receives about 45 days in the county jail. First offenders may get as little time as 5 to 10 days. Repeat offenders may get up to a year in state prison.
Congressman Leon Panetta, 3, 2, 1. Congressman Leon Panetta of the 16th District is finishing up his first term in office. Panetta was chosen as a freshman chairman of the House for his class. This, of course, was an honor for Panetta, but we asked if this was a working honor.
I felt that it was a position in which I would use the opportunity to provide briefings for members on issues. After all, most of the members were not familiar with the major issues that Congress was dealing with. So we had a series of briefings from the State Department, Defense Department, almost every department in the government on issues that were facing the Congress. In addition to that, we took some very strong positions on ethics issues, which we felt were particularly important relating to the Korean investigation as well as the ethics of the House itself. And then thirdly, we try to help are individual members in particular problems involved in their offices, such as space, management of the office, to try to assist members in dealing with the particular problems that congressmen face. And so those services were the ones we provided, and I'm really very pleased as to what we were able to do.
We then asked a freshman congressman if he feels the legislative process works.
I think it does. I guess that's probably the one thing I can say after a year and a half, having been tremendously discouraged by the process when I was back there initially in Washington, and having seen the process abused, I had kind of lost hope as to whether the process could really work effectively. And what I've seen is a process that can work. It's not something that's going to happen automatically, though, and that's the great frustration. You see a problem and you want to come up with a solution as quickly as possible, but that doesn't happen in our democratic process. People will challenge that solution. They have their own ideas. People want to participate in the process. They want to talk to an issue. It's a slow process. It's sometimes very ineffective and inefficient. I guess a monarchy or a tyranny can sometimes be a much more efficient form of government for immediately moving on answers, but the sacrifice is the rights of people in that kind of form of government. In a democratic process, we allow people to participate, and that, I think, makes this the best form of government that we have.
That's Congressman Leon Panetta. For 91 News Watch, this is Dave Curley. Panetta, story two on the count. 3, 2, 1. Congressman for the 16th District, Leon Panetta, has been in office for a little over a year and a half now, and 91 News Watch asked him if the congressional life is what he thought it would be.
Well, I think I have found this, the business of being a representative, very exciting and also very frustrating, and I guess that's the nature of our democratic process. It's very challenging to try to serve people in the district, and we've been serving something like over 3,000 individual cases within the district, and that has been, I think, tremendous satisfaction to be able to try to make the process work for people in getting a Social Security check or a veterans benefit or an education benefit of some sort.
We then asked Panetta how he felt about the legislation process.
I've been pleased to have a number of amendments adopted by the House and actually passed into law in the year and a half that I've been there, and I have some key proposals, particularly on the budget and on water, that I really want to work at in the next 2 years to try to complete those. So those are principally the targets I have in mind, and as I say, although it's a frustrating process, it is perhaps the best process in the world in trying to deal with the problems of people.
That's Congressman Leon Panetta of the 16th District. For 91 News Watch, this is Dave Curley.
First part of a four-part series on Jarvis Gann. Over the past 10 years, the steady rise in property taxes, particularly that portion levied on homes, has led to several efforts to limit the use of property tax, both through the initiative and the legislative process. The most controversial of the propositions that the voters will be faced with this year is a Jarvis Gann initiative. The proposed initiative constitutional amendment is designed to limit and reduce taxes levied on property and to make increasing other taxes by state and local governments more difficult. The initiative is actually designed to accomplish 4 points, the most important being a limit on property taxes to 1% of full cash value. The counties would collect the taxes and apportion them according to the laws that pertain to districts within counties. The limitation would not include taxes or assessments to pay for bonded indebtedness already approved by the voters. The second point defines full cash value as the county assessor's 1975-76 appraised value, or the current value when purchased or newly constructed. It limits any increases in assessed values to 2% a year. The third point would require 2/3 vote of the legislature to increase the level of state taxes. Now, currently, only a simple majority is required. The legislature would also be prohibited from levying a property tax or a property sales or transaction tax. A fourth point would permit local governments to impose special taxes, except on property, by a 2/3 vote of the qualified electorate. If the Jarvis-Gann initiative passes on the June ballot, it will become effective on July 1st of 1978. Except point 3, which requires 2/3 vote of the legislature, this point becomes effective upon passage. Stay tuned to 91 Newswatch, where we'll explore the problems of Jarvis-Gann. For 91 Newswatch, this is Paula Chambers. Part 2 of the Jarvis-Gann. 3, 2, 1. This is the second part of a series of features discussing the Jarvis-Gann initiative. In the past few years, the average property tax has actually declined. The current concern is a result of the upward spiral of the cost of residential property and the consequent increases in assessed value. The Jarvis-Gann initiative, Proposition 13 on the June ballot, seeks to relieve the homeowner of the increasing tax burden. The proponents of Proposition 13 estimate a $6 billion, or 64%, reduction on property tax revenues. As a result of this loss, it is widely recognized that expenditures and services provided by local governments, schools, cities, counties, and special districts would have to be curtailed, or the legislature would have to act to provide for the replacement of most of the local losses with other revenues. That's either from state tax sources or by providing new tax sources to local government. Supposedly, the lost revenues would be counteracted by using state surplus funds and by freezing state and local budgets at the 1977-1978 level and giving no wage increases. In the future, reductions in expenditures would be made by reducing governmental workforces and by cutting non-essential spending. Officials estimate that the current state tax system will generate beyond anticipated expenditures in future years. Accordingly, this amount would be used for funding of property tax relief as an alternative to the initiative. One area affected by the initiative would be education. Proponents of the Proposition 13 have asked that property taxes be used only for the property-related services. Therefore, the state would assume full responsibility for funding of schools by use of sales tax. The proponents estimate that the cost at about $3.5 billion. However, state officials say that if programs were maintained at the current level, the cost would be about $6.2 billion. To fund this amount through sales tax would require a rate increase of 6.5 cents for the average state and local sales tax rate of 12.5 cents. For more information on the Jarvis-Gann initiative, stay tuned for the third part of 91 Newswatch's coverage within the next half hour. For 91 Newswatch, this is Paula Chambers. Part 3 of Jarvis-Gann. 3, 2, 1. This is the third part of a four-part series on the Jarvis-Gann initiative. Reduction of property tax revenues and their effects on education were previously discussed. However, the initiative also drastically affects counties. If counties are to reduce expenditures to accommodate lost revenue, the legislature would have to decide on some reductions in state-mandated programs. The state would take over that portion of health and welfare costs currently paid for with property taxes. The California Taxpayers Association estimates that if the state had taken over these programs in 1977-78, property tax relief would have totaled $1.2 billion. Health and welfare program reductions could be made. However, it would be necessary to maintain the levels mandated by federal requirements to avoid substantial loss of federal funds or, in some cases, violation of the federal law. As far as other taxes are concerned, state officials maintain that when general property tax relief is provided, all property owners benefit, but particularly owners of business and commercial property. Because they pay approximately 65% of all property taxes, but a relatively small amount to state general fund revenues, businesses realize a greater tax savings with reduced property taxes. As a result, the proportionate share of all taxes paid by individuals rise. Possible increased state income and sales taxes would further shift the tax burden. If Proposition 13 passes, property taxpayers would pay higher federal income taxes because of lower property tax deductions. It's estimated by the State Franchise Tax Board that this additional income tax would amount to $1.9 billion and reduce the projected $7 billion savings to the taxpayers. Republican gubernatorial candidate Ken Matty claims a Jarvis-Gann proposition would wreak havoc on state and local government. He believes that there are more effective means of cutting taxes. It is so drastic, he states, that it would somehow be evaded. What Matty proposes is a constitutional limit on state spending and a 20% across-the-board tax cut in a comprehensive issue statement on taxation. Matty believes that Jarvis-Gann simply does not go far enough. Says Matty, the best solution to California's tax and economic problems would be to guarantee a halt to growth of government through a constitutional amendment, limiting state spending, combined with across-the-board tax cuts, which will increase revenue while providing real tax relief. According to Matty, a 20% cut will actually result in an increase in revenues within 3 years. Business expansion will result as investors find California more appealing, and jobs will be created, people will have more money to spend, and our economy will boom, he states. Stay tuned for the final presentation of 91 Newswatch's coverage of the Jarvis-Gann Initiative in the next half hour to hear the arguments of both sides. For 91 Newswatch, this is Paula Chambers. Part 4 of Jarvis-Gann. 3, 2, 1. This is the final presentation of a four-part series on the Jarvis-Gann Initiative. The question, should the Constitution be amended to place a limit on property taxes and to make raising other taxes more difficult? Arguments four include fiscal responsibility and a tax system responsive to our real needs is imperative. Fiscal constraints would force a reordering of our long-range priorities. The initiative would improve the business climate by signaling to business leaders the California voters' determination to hold down the cost of government. Proponents say that homeowners would benefit. The average property tax burden could be reduced 64%. Renters would also benefit. A major cause of skyrocketing rents is the necessity of passing on tax increases to tenants. If apartment owners' taxes are reduced, then those savings can be passed along too. However, the arguments against state that the measure is not fiscally responsible. It would cause financial chaos, drastic reductions in police and fire protection, and bankrupt the schools, unless other revenues were provided. Some bonds would be in danger of default. Overall, homeowners would not benefit. A sizable part of the savings would disappear in higher federal and state income taxes, as well as other state taxes. Landlords would not have to pass on their savings to renters, but renters would have to pay a full share of any increases in sales and income tax which were imposed. Unless businesses pass on their tax savings, they would be getting a windfall at the expense of the consumer. The choice is up to you. Whether or not the Jarvis-Gann proposition will or can effectively reduce taxes without detrimentally affecting other areas of state and local government. For 91 Newswatch, this is Paula Chambers. Proposition 11. 3, 2, 1. Taxes are a big issue on this June's ballot. First, there's Proposition 13, Jarvis Gann, which is the reduction of property tax revenues. But there's also Proposition 11. That's a taxation of county-owned real property. The situation stands that for many years, the requirements for the formation of all counties were stringent. Under a 1974 law, these were eased, and some proposals to create new counties have since been put forth. Procedures for formation of counties are spelled out in the law. A new county is created only if a majority of the voters in the entire existing county and area approve. The Constitution requires that land and improvements owned by counties and other local governments outside their boundaries are taxable if they were taxable when originally acquired. The Constitution also requires that taxable land and improvements belonging to local governments be assessed by the county in which they are located. Proposition 11 proposes that the constitutional amendment would allow counties to retain the tax-exempt status of property that they own in locations which become part of new counties. This does not directly involve San Luis Obispo County at this time. This amendment would apply only to property in counties which were formed after January 1, 1978, and that could happen to us. Now, the question is whether the Constitution be amended to allow counties to retain the tax-exempt status of property they own in areas which become part of counties which are formed after January 1st of this year. Arguments for include the purpose of Proposition 11 is to protect the taxpayers of a county from being taxed for county-owned properties located in a seceding county. The existing law was intended to prevent the reduction of the tax base of a county where another county owns large amounts of tax-free property. It does not adequately cover problems arising from formations of new counties. This measure would not allow any county to go into another and buy up areas which would then be tax-exempt. Arguments against include facilities such as jails and airports require services which are supported by local taxpayers. Now, owners of the property, even if they are taxpayers in another county, should be taxed. Passage of Proposition 11 may form the basis to challenge the requirement that property owned by a county outside its boundaries is subject to taxation, even if taxable when originally acquired. This should not be changed. For 91 Newswatch, this is Paula Chambers. A man who instructs teachers how to teach recently set out to test the relevance of what he's telling them. Dewey Chambers, a professor at the University of the Pacific, took a semester's leave of absence to teach at a school in Stockton, California. He covered just about every subject in grades from kindergarten through sixth grade, and says he finds his college is providing generally relevant training. But, he said, I think I have to talk to my student teachers about greater organization of the classroom and the overuse of mass media. He also suggested too little is done for the above-average students, whereas there are many programs for poor children or those with learning problems. He also found, by the way, heavy emphasis on the basics, almost to the exclusion of other ideas, as he put it. He said this is what has been giving rise to what he calls all the hardware that's being used in schools. Too much hardware, in his opinion. For 91 Newswatch, this is Paula Chambers. There are about 9,000 of them in the New York City school system, scattered among the schools in all areas, privileged and underprivileged. Often, they don't hold college degrees, but they're on their way up the ladder, literally. They're the school system's paraprofessionals. Frank Hatley, coordinator of the career training program for the paras, as they're called, told Women Today that there are two basic types: educational assistants, by far the larger number, and family auxiliaries. The educational assistants work with the children with learning and other problems, and with attendance officers and help the school administration. The family auxiliaries try to help children with problem homes, including health. The Board of Education, under its Career Ladder program, pays for the paras to take courses towards professional degrees at the City University. Some of the paras already have degrees. Often, there would be teachers who haven't found jobs yet. The coordinator of paraprofessionals for one district notes the vast majority are women. She suggests one reason is men would find it hard to support their families on the salary. For 91 Newswatch, this is Paula Chambers.
For the students, faculty, and staff here at Cal Poly, the Foundation Food Service is very important. They're the people who control all of the food outlets and all of the vendoring and catering services here on campus. These are also the people who administer and are in charge of the meal tickets. It was last year that Dr. Kennedy and the administration decided that all students who lived in the residence dorms had to have a meal ticket. This was agreeable to some and not so agreeable to others. 91 Newswatch talked with Al Smith, the administrative assistant for the Foundation Food Service, and he told us what they offer the student for a meal plan.
The meal plan has basically changed in the sense now that it is a mandatory meal ticket for all students who live in the residence halls. The meal ticket itself has changed to a 19 and 14 versus last year we offered a 19, 15, and a 12. The popular plan, about two-thirds of our students have purchased the 14 meal plan, the other third taking the 19.
Some students disagree with many of the basic policies of the meal ticket. One of the largest gripes is that the student must pay extra if he goes over the allotted money equivalency on a la carte items, but doesn't get reimbursed if he is under this amount. Smith explains the reason for this.
The basic reason for not providing a refund is that the whole meal ticket is priced out so that we have to survive throughout the year based on a predetermined amount of money that we get in each year. So it would create a financial nightmare for us if we started refunding money. Students could obviously use that as a gimmick to basically cash in, you know, half of their meal ticket if they wanted to.
Along with Mr. Everett Duro, the head of the food services, Smith is planning to make some appearance and convenience changes for next year.
Carpeting, additional planters out there to try and break up that large hall type environment. We're going to try and introduce maybe some new more popular foods on a continual basis. What we are calling right off the cuff is a mini shop concept, where students can go in and they can, if they don't want to take what's for the entree that night, they can go into one of these mini shops and say this week they're running crepes. They can get a crepe for dinner. There'll always be hamburgers and French fries there.
For 91 Newswatch, this is Tim Tomastic reporting. Proposition 1 on this year's state ballot measures is the State School Building Aid Bond Law of 1978. The proposal is that the proposition would authorize the state to issue $350 million in general obligation bonds for two programs. $100 million would be used to continue the 1952 State School Building Aid Program. $250 million would be allocated to the New Lease Purchase Program to help school districts build new facilities in high-growth attendance areas and to reconstruct and replace buildings which are more than 30 years old. The state would pay for the construction or the remodeling of the school buildings and then lease them to the district. A majority of local voters must approve the entry into a lease purchase agreement, and the district would be required to repay the full cost of the bonds, principal and interest, to the state. The question on this issue is, should the state issue general obligation bonds to provide $350 million for school buildings programs? One argument for this is the lease purchase program under Proposition 1 would provide a less complicated and less costly way for school districts to modernize or replace old school buildings. An argument against Proposition 1 is that 100% financed by the taxpayers. General obligation bonds are debts of the state, and continued borrowing is unwise. For 91 Newswatch, this is Tim Tomastic reporting. This year, the voters of California will also be voting for Proposition 2 on the state ballot measures, which is the Clean Water and Water Conservation Bond Law of 1978. The proposal states that the Clean Water and Water Conservation Bond Law of 1978 will authorize the sale of $375 million in state general obligation bonds. These bonds would provide money to continue state grants to local agencies to pay for 12.5% of the total cost of sewage treatment facilities that are eligible for federal grants. It would also provide that state grants to local agencies are not eligible for federal clean water grants to prevent water pollution or to conserve to reclaim water. And for state loans and local agencies for water pollution control or water reclamation facilities. The question is, should the state authorize $375 million in general obligation bonds to provide grants to local agencies to build sewage treatment facilities and water reclamation and water conservation projects? One argument for Proposition 2 is that many local agencies still need to construct projects to meet mandatory water quality standards, and water quality is a statewide concern that deserves state financial assistance. And an argument against this proposition is that many projects in the past have been more costly than stated by the proponents and therefore unfair to the taxpayer. For 91 News Watch, this is Tim Tomastic reporting. Proposition 3 on this year's state ballot measures is one of taxation exemption for alternative energy systems. Proposition 3 is a constitutional amendment which would add property uses for alternative energy systems to the present list of exemptions in the Constitution. If Proposition 3 passes by companion bill, it would also become law. Beginning July 1979, this bill provides a 5-year exemption from the property tax for solar energy systems attached to residential or non-residential buildings or swimming pools. The question is, should the legislature have the authority to exempt from property taxation the value of alternative energy systems installed in homes and other buildings and swimming pools? An argument for Proposition 3 is that development of non-polluting sources of energy will protect the California environment and cut down our reliance on foreign oil. An argument against Proposition 3 is that any tax exemption is a subsidy to the property exempted and other taxpayers must pay the difference. For 91 News Watch, this is Tim Tomastic reporting.